If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
This land was made for you and me.
Are you sure? Are you really sure that this land was made for you and me? 720 WGN, John Landecker. Yeah, starting out a little different tonight. That's Woody Guthrie, of course, and the classic This Land Is Your Land, which is celebrating an anniversary this year. And earlier this year, Nora Guthrie, Woody Guthrie's daughter, came on with us, and we've invited her back. Good evening, Nora. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing well. So what anniversary, what anniversary was it for This Land Is Your Land? What year?
It was written in 1940.
Okay.
Can you do the math quickly?
I should say not. It was my absolute worst. This math is not my math. This math is your math. No, I can. that's the sum of my comments. So anyway, Nora was here in February, and we were talking about the anniversary of that song. And of course, there was renewed interest in Woody Guthrie via the Complete Unknown biopic that had Timothy Chalamet as Bob Dylan. And I think more people have seen it now than when we originally talked, because it's been up on streaming services. And I think when we originally discussed it, it was only in theaters. And anyway, so there's a scene in the movie, at the beginning of the movie, where Bob Dylan goes to visit Woody Guthrie in New York. And that's true. And I'm going to play a clip of what happened when, this isn't in the movie, but it would have been great if it was, if when the first time Bob Dylan goes over to Woody Guthrie's apartment and wants to get in. Let's see.
I was watching American Bandstand at the time. Yeah. No, we were watching American Bandstand doing the stroll. It was 1961.
Wow.
And I remember when he came over, I was 11 years old at the time, and he was kind of a funky folk singer looking for other funky folk singers like my dad. And I was like, I was so disinterested because he was interrupting American Bandstand. I said, oh, my dad's not here. And I slammed the door and went back and watched television.
Well, not a, that's just a great story. That should have been in the movie. I think people would have loved that, Norm. I mean, come on. It's still good. When you told us that story originally, I was like a little gobsmacked. I'm like, that is just an amazing story. And it made me feel better about when I was 11 years old. And maybe I wasn't into folk music as much as I was later. And I guess that's all right, because you know what? I was into that American Bandstand too, boy. I think a lot of us were.
And so, I think, you know, your hormones when you're preteen, and they're starting to come in, and all you really care about is learning the next dance and seeing who's doing it. The older teenagers, the 13 and 14-year-olds. So I had absolutely no patience for him at the time.
We're moving past that, though. The this is the anniversary. Today's the anniversary of a musical project called Mermaid Avenue, which we'll tell you the entire story of, which was talked about it. We talked about it a little bit the last time you were on, but I think we can really sort of get into it tonight, which I think it's important that people hear this and also hear some of the music, because the only way this music would ever have been heard is because of this project, because your dad stopped recording, but he didn't stop writing. So you're in charge of the whole Woody Guthrie, whatever you call it. It's, you know, his memory, his music, his whatever. And you found how many sets of lyrics that had never been recorded?
I found about 3,000 lyrics altogether. And I think he had recorded, I'm going to say the top at the most 300 in his lifetime.
Wow.
So there were about 2,700 lyrics that were left incompleted. He didn't write music notation.
Right.
So if he didn't record the songs, sometimes on a tape recorder, he had an old tape recorder, and he would just sing along, and that's how the melody would be preserved. But if he didn't do that, then there was no record of the music at all. And this was many, many years. My father passed away in 1967, and I got a look at all of these boxes, which I have to confess were in my house my whole lifetime, and I never bothered to look at them because I'm a kid, you know, right? You don't want to look in your parents' boxes. And it wasn't until I was 45, really, that I kind of took an interest. I was like, what's in there? And you know what's funny, John? When I first opened the boxes and I reached in, I just started pulling stuff out. You know what I found? One of the first things was a letter that had Lennon as the return address. And when I opened up the envelope, it was a letter from John Lennon. So that kind of got me started. Like, what else is in here?
I would think so. Do you remember the content of that letter? What did Lennon have to say for your dad? I would hope so. Yeah.
He wrote it in, I think it was 1973. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he had already moved to New York. My dad had passed away. And he had been reading Bound for Glory. And I think he was also in trouble with Nixon at that time over the Vietnam War. And they were trying to get rid of him. And he was empowered by learning my father's story. And so the letter said, "To whom it may concern, dear Woody Guthrie, you live, you're still living with me, and I thank you," something like that. Woody still lives, and signed with love, John Lennon. And, you know, that's been the metaphor, actually, for so many people that maybe we'll talk about some of them today, whether it's Wilco or Billy Bragg or Springsteen or Dylan. That's really been the heartthrob between all these musicians, that it's not necessarily every song that Woody wrote that they emulated or learned from or continue to sing, but this empowerment that he gives so many musicians.
The project that eventually emerged from all of this is called Mermaid Avenue, and it's with Billy Bragg and Wilco. And we're going to play some of it and talk about it when we come back on 720 WGN. Rick, that's not from the Mermaid Avenue session, but as I was getting information together for tonight to talk to you, Nora, I had to check this out. I don't know how many times, but that's you, right?
Uh-oh. You found me out.
I did. I was. Yeah. I'm like, wait a minute. This can't be true. Okay, so it says Nora Guthrie here and all this, and I check and I go back, and every time I come back, I arrive at the same place. And that place is that song plus a couple of others that you recorded. What was the story behind that?
Oh, I was a young teenager, 17 or something, and I was friends with John Sebastian and the Loving Spoonful at the time. We lived near each other in New York City. And I used to sing, you know, around the house or whatever. And John said, "You ought to sing." And he introduced me to a guy, and I made a record or two. But you know what? At the same time, Janis Ian was taken off. And we're both about the same height. We both had dark, curly hair. And Janis was just a genius and brilliant. Yeah. And I thought, you know, let her have it. Let her have the spotlight. So I decided to become a dancer instead. And that was a good choice for me and good choice for Janis too, right?
Yes. 720 WGN, John Landecker talking to Nora Guthrie, who runs the Woody Guthrie Foundation. And it was just a big surprise to me, Nora, that I found that. And a bunch of other stuff, too. We're talking about the making of an album called Mermaid Avenue, which, correct me if I'm wrong about this, is music that's performed by Wilco and some other people and Billy Bragg, and it's lyrics that were written by Woody Guthrie that were never recorded and were part of a, I don't know, 3,000 songs that you found, right? And
correct. Yeah.
So that's what this is about. And
yeah, And it's your home boys. It's your home team.
Yeah,
welcome.
I know. I know it is. Yeah.
I want to do a shout out to the boys there.
And I also ran into a really, I thought, great documentary called The Man in the Sand, which is on YouTube, which is the making of Mermaid Avenue. And it starts out in, how do you say the name of that town in Oklahoma? Ofeski? Is that it?
Okema.
Okema.
Yeah.
Well, I really got
but
that
actually,
wrong.
You know, the album really got born with Billy Bragg. He was kind of the father. I was the mother. He was the father of the project. Yeah. And we were all at a music festival together, and Billy had signed on to take on some of these lyrics. I had offered them to a number of other well-known singers at the time, and all that they were really excited about doing it. But then their managers told me, well, they're on tour for 3 years, so maybe we could start then. And I didn't have the patience to wait for these other artists. And Billy is kind of he comes out of punk rock, actually.
Yeah. Yes.
And he was like, I'm raring to go. And I said, come on, let's just go do this. And, you know, screw the big guys. And then we were at this concert venue together, and Wilco was playing at the same venue. And Billy said to me, go over and ask Wilco if they'd be part of it. And I did. And they said, okay. And then Natalie Merchant was singing at the same thing. And Billy said, go over and talk to Natalie, see if she'll do a song or two. And I did. And she said, yes. And the whole thing kind of came together in about 1 hour backstage at a music festival. And
that, they all gave a verbal commitment at that concert backstage.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it was really exciting because it felt like a little bit almost dangerous in a way, because people that knew and loved my father for what he had already sung and written, the Dust Bowl ballads and This Land Is Your Land and all that stuff, they said, well, you can't mess with Woody Guthrie lyrics. You know, it's kind of sacrosanct material. And I thought, no, it's not. It's just a bunch of lyrics written by a young guy. You know, he was like 27, 28, 29 when he wrote a lot of this stuff. And I said, you know, it's just lyrics, guys. It's not God. And so we just had so much fun. We recorded in Dublin. And everyone just kind of cut loose, you know. And I think that's the fun of the whole album that surprised everyone, is just how much fun you could hear in the music and the new interpretation. A lyric is just a story, and it could be told with many different kinds of instruments and many different kinds of records, etc. So, you know, we took a kind of light-handed touch to the whole thing, and I think that's why it was so successful.
Well, the lyrics are cover of a wide range of attitudes and events, and they all have a different feeling, more or less. And they're not this collection of woe is me, you know, the government's crazy, everybody's in a labor union, rise up and revolt. Right. I mean, yeah, there are that's part of it. I mean, you know, it's Woody Guthrie.
Right.
But there's all this other stuff that has absolutely, that's like fun and love songs and songs for kids and just great sounding music, period. That the band and Billy Bragg and Tweety, they had to write the music for these lyrics. Is that correct?
Yeah. Billy and Jeff Tweety shared the compositions, kind of like, you know, Lennon McCartney.
Yeah, sure.
They each picked lyrics that they could connect to. And it was really interesting, too, because we had so many, you know, time had passed. A lot of time had passed since my dad had written a lot of these lyrics. And I remember there was one song on the album called Hoodoo Voodoo. And it was just a silly kid song with fun words and made up words and everything. And I remember at the time, all the rock groups, they were all jumping up and down doing like this pogo stick thing. You remember that time?
Yes, I do.
In the 90s or 80s, late 80s. Everyone was like jumping up and down, you know. And I said to Jeff Tweedy, I said, you got to have like one song that's like a pogo dance thing.
And so that's it.
He did Hoodoo Voodoo. You know, it's your jump up and down rock and roll song.
Which your
so
dad
had like funny references for a lot of the different songs.
Which your dad wrote intentionally for, I thought it was for you kids. Or
it is.
Yeah, I mean
it's a nonsensical children's lyric, you know. Well, he wrote a lot of stuff like that. He was in love with just phonetics and enunciation, so he wrote a lot of songs that were just fun for your mouth to do.
and you know, I guess I'll play my hand. You know, I had to pick some songs to play during this hour. And while I was doing that, I'm like thinking, what a task it must have been for you and everybody involved in the Mermaid Avenue project to go through all these lyrics and decide which one you wanted to play. And I'm here with a couple of CDs, and I'm having a hard time figuring out which ones I want to play. You know, I mean, it's
interesting. Some of them have become real staples in the different artist shows, like Ingrid Bergman and Way Over Yonder in the Minor Key have become staples in a Billy Bragg show. To this day, 25 years later, he still does those songs. And Wilco does Airline to Heaven and California Stars. So they've become staples in their show. So I think that's it's so important to me, like just emotionally, to know that these songs have really taken on their own life. And you don't necessarily think of Woody Guthrie when you hear the songs. You're supposed to be thinking about Wilco. You're supposed to be thinking about Billy Bragg. And I told all the guys, like, do not look up at Woody when you write your music. See, if you can't see him eye to eye, you're not the right guy to do this. Wow. And they need to be a team, you know? You're not looking up at him. I said, look eye to eye and you'll be okay. guy to guy.
Well, I think that it was, you know, your input and your guidance of these musicians that actually culminated in the way that this turned out, which is just so great. I mean, I've been listening to both CDs and the songs are really just great songs about a whole variety of subjects with great, obviously great lyrics that your dad wrote, but also the music that, Bragg and Tweedy and Wilco put behind them is really, they look like, you know what it sounds like? It sounds like that they were made for each other. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't sound like your dad's lyrics were written 30, 40, 50 years ago, and these guys are in a studio and they're going to put fresh music to it. It sounds like that it was all written in one project. You know what I mean? It all just fits together.
That's what I was just saying. Like, I don't want them to look up to Woody. I want them to, like, you're a guy, I'm a guy. We're in the same room with Lennon McCartney, and we're just going to work together on this. And I think that's the beauty of so many of the songs. Like I say, I actually, in the beginning, didn't want to even mention Woody's name in the project. I didn't even want to, you know, for the record company, like, let's say anonymous, you know, lyrics by anonymous or something like that, because I didn't want people to have preconceived ideas of what the music should be.
Well, you know what?
But I think the guys managed to transcend that just with their own talents.
Well, you know, we're going to take a break for the news, and when we come back, you'll hear an exact example of what we were just been talking about. It's the bottom of the hour, time to get into the WGN newsroom.
That's a goofy day.
720 WGN, that's what we're talking about. John Landecker, that is what we're talking about. And every time I hear it, it's like, that's Woody Guthrie? I mean, it's just like, that's a rock band going at it, you know? And it's so great to know that those are lyrics that you discovered from your dad and that they put that together and it's got that great sound. We're talking.
You know, I'm listening to on your commercials there with the union. It's so interesting. My father's favorite word, pay attention, was union. All kinds of union. Union between workers, union between lovers, union between families, between countries. And he wrote about all kinds of unions. And John, I was just in Chicago with my family. I brought my kids and my grandkids, the whole troop. We came to Chicago, and I wanted to teach them a little bit about the labor movement there, which is mm-hmm. so important. Yeah. And we did actually a tour with a tour guide to the Chicago Labor Society, the Illinois State Labor Society. And there's a wonderful musician there in Chicago named Bucky Hawker, who specializes in labor songs, Illinois labor songs. And I brought them all to his house, and he sang all these great labor songs to my grandchildren and my kids. So, you know, Chicago is so much in my soul because of the union stories that take place here, not to mention the blues and the other things that are going on here in Chicago.
Great minds think alike. May I use that expression, because I'm listening to the commercials we're playing too. And as that one mm-hmm. went by talking about the union and what they want to accomplish, I said to my producer, Jack, I said, listen to that. How about that? I mean, it fits perfectly. I mean,
And Studs Terkel, you know, people like that in Chicago that were good friends and co-workers with my mm-hmm. dad as well. But it's funny, the rock and roll connection came to me in 1968. After my dad had died, they did a tribute concert at Carnegie Hall. And it was actually Dylan's idea to do it. He called up and said, we got to do something. And he came with a bunch of musicians, which he called, it was the band. But it wasn't the band. It was the band.
You mean
and
the band?
That was first. It was, yeah, but it wasn't like they weren't the band. It was just, this is the band. And they rocked a couple of my dad's songs. I'll never forget it. And I was jumping up and down. I was like 17 or 18. And I thought, now this is great music.
I bet.
And it was all my father's songs, but they just rocked it, you know. And that was a big transition. Reminds me of the movie that you were just talking about, A Complete Unknown. This transition of Dylan going into electric guitar and rock sounding music. But my dad always felt that the instrumentation was kind of the personality of the artist, but not the soul, not the essence of an artist. The lyrics are the soul of the music, and everything else is the costume or the, you know, what you put on it, what color you want to give it, or what costume you want to make it musically. But my father really appreciated all the different kinds of music, even rock and roll and everything else. So I thought it was great, you know, even talking about the movie. I thought they did a great job.
I did. Oh, absolutely. And I also, as I'm listening to all these songs on Mermaid Avenue, I'm considering the time in American history that your dad was forming his musical catalog, so to speak. I mean, we have the Dust Bowl, which if people don't know, they should check it out because it's really quite horrible, and it had a really bad effect on a lot of people who packed up their families and went to the West Coast and had to stay in camps, and it was the largest
American migration in the history of the country.
And it was really
hundreds of thousands of people in the West and Midwest lost their farms due to environmental disasters that were taken, et cetera. So but Dad lived through the Dust Bowl era, the Depression era, World War II era, McCarthy period, racism. I mean, there were so many things going on, and he was an avid news guy, and because he wasn't concerned about making a living as a musician. He was concerned about what the music was saying.
Yeah.
So he would often disappear to a boycott or a protest or a rally or something and come home a couple of days later. My mother would, I remember once he came home without a jacket, and my mother said, "Where's the coat?" And we didn't have any money. And she's like, "We can't afford a coat. Woody, where's your coat?" And he said, "I gave it to a guy who looked colder than I am."
Wow.
And he was that kind of guy, you know. We had a tin box in the house where he kept cash, loose cash, but it was unlocked. And when you opened up the box, there was a note that said, "Dear robber, if you need this more than I do, you're welcome to it."
Wow.
But I mean, you know what I mean? That's I'm trying to give you a sense of what music was to him, as opposed to a career or an industry. It was something else. And I've always tried to work with musicians like Billy Bragg and Wilco that are aware and conscious of that relationship of music to the real world.
You know, I think a lot of people, well, maybe I'll take that back. I'll use Bruce Springsteen as an example. You mentioned him earlier this hour. He starts out as, and still is, a person who has an opinion about a variety of topics, some of them political, some having to do with war. I mean, people think "Born in the USA" is a great rah-rah USA song. It's an anti-Vietnam War song. I mean, they never really got into the entirety of the lyrics. And the thing is that he just became really successful. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like he had the attitude and he had the songs and he sold a lot of them. What can you say? I mean,
I've worked with Bruce a number of times, and I've produced concerts that he's been part of and did some recordings, etc. So I know his MO. I know where he comes from, mm-hmm. Spiritually and consciously and all that kind of stuff. And as a matter of fact, you know what he's doing? He's on tour now. And after his concert is over, he's in Europe. He plays "This Land Is Your Land" for the exit song.
No kidding.
For his shows.
He plays it, or he plays your dad?
It's a recording of him doing it, but he doesn't play it live. But I've worked with everyone from Tom Morello, Rage Against the Machine, mm-hmm. and punk rockers like Dropkick Murphys. I did two albums with them. And they're all, I guess the point I'm trying to say is, again, it's not the instrumentation. It's not the genre. It's, you know, Dropkick Murphys has one way of saying the same thing in a way that Bruce Springsteen does, that Woody does, that Billy Bragg and Wilco do. And there's a lot of other singers that I can't mention. I just don't have time.
Right.
But anyway, So Bruce is a cool guy.
No, and I just wanted to use that as an example of somebody who I think emulates attitude in their lyrics and found themselves in the midst of a great success. And this goes back, I don't want to guess the year. He ends up on the cover of Newsweek and Time on the same week. And the word is, see, he sold out, it's over. Well, it wasn't, but I mean, that's the kind of thing that can happen. We're talking to Nora Guthrie, president of Woody Guthrie Foundation, Woody Guthrie Publications, founder of Woody Guthrie Archive, and a musical project that was done called Mermaid Avenue. And I'm going to play one of my favorite things that I found on Mermaid Avenue, just a clip of it, when we come back on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, 749 with John Landecker and Nora Guthrie, and that's a cut from Mermaid Avenue called One by One, which really touched me, quite frankly.
Pretty sad song, huh?
Well, yes and no, because in the end it says, "One by one I hear the soft words that you whispered. One by one, I feel your kisses soft and sweet. One by one, I hope you'll say the words to Mary. One by one, to one by one, forever be." And I'm like, whoa.
You know what's interesting, John? If you had heard someone with like a really, really good voice doing that, I don't think it would have touched you. I think there's a rawness in Jeff's performance that makes that song. That's what you're responding to in terms of not just the lyrics, but the performance is so important.
Yeah. And again, not something I think the average person would associate with Woody Guthrie, a lyric like that, you know? I mean,
There's another lyric that's kind of sad. "Another Man's Done Gone" that's on the album. And he's writing about when he's gone and he doesn't want like a big Megillah. You know, he'd just say, it's just say another man's done gone. There were certain things I should have done. Maybe I didn't do enough. Maybe I, you know, didn't love enough, whatever it is. But basically, it's just another man done gone. And I remember when we were in the studio with that one, Jay Bennett was putting a melody to it first, and he was just twiddling on the piano in the studio. And I told the engineer, I said, just sneak a mic in there. Like, don't even tell him that we're recording. Yeah. And I said, Jeff, can you just sing along? And that happened so organically again. It wasn't like too much of a performance. It's like real people singing by, they're like talking, singing, you know what I mean? Like you really, it's like they're singing a script as opposed yes. to a lyric that rhymes a do-si-do-si-do-si-do, you know? Right. It's really interesting. Yeah.
There's a lot of different, different songs on Mermaid Avenue, but, and I'll be a little flippant about this. What's the deal with Ingrid Bergman?
What's the deal with Ingrid Bergman?
Yeah.
Oh, well, ask every guy in the world what they think of Ingrid Bergman in 1940 or whatever it was. You know, she was pretty hot stuff.
Yeah, I know.
And she was doing a film at the time on the island of Stromboli in Italy.
Yeah.
And it was about a volcano. And Woody kind of uses the eruption of the volcano as a metaphor his desires for Ingrid Bergman. But he wasn't alone in this. Come on.
No, I know. I know. Yeah. I know. Absolutely. But I thought it was a very unique Woody Guthrie song that was obviously an open message to Ingrid Bergman about what he felt. And,
yeah,
you know, that's the same. You know, guy who
I'd have to say one of the things about my dad that I really, really, really love is that he never edited himself. Mm. If he was writing about a sexual feeling, he just wrote it. If he was writing about a political thing, he just said it. If he was writing a kid's silly song, he just did it and didn't apologize for being silly, for being sexual, for being political. He was all over the place unapologetically and without self-editing. And that's what I actually appreciate most about his writing. And I've learned from that, too. I hope any singer-songwriters that are listening take that into account, too. You know, not to stop yourself from expressing who you are and how you feel about lots of different things. And I remember doing a Songwriters Hall of Fame event a couple of years ago. They had a Pioneers Award that they gave to my father, and I had to accept it. And you know what I did, John? I went through the alphabet and I read the lyrics to every song from A to Z. And it's like everything from a guy with, you know, Alfredo something to a song about a zoo to, you know, the letter Z. Yeah. And I said to everybody, I said, that's a songwriter. You just write everything about anything about everything. And it's all there from A to Z. You can find any idea that's in the Woody Guthrie archive that he wrote about, unedited, uncensored, and not judgmental. You know, he didn't judge his, you know, when I say there were 3,000 lyrics that I found, by the way, they're not all good. Just because he wrote them doesn't mean they're good.
Right, 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 right.
You know, that's another thing I have to point out. Don't be afraid of writing a bad song. You don't have to use it. You don't have to record it, but don't be afraid of writing it.
You know, that is a great message on a lot of different levels. The fear of failure is something that I think a lot of people have when they approach a certain project or whatever. And, you know, not every actor, when they go into the movies, not every movie they do turns out to be fantastic. Yet, you know, they still move on and maybe learn from it because that's just part of the whole deal. Some things, you can't write 3,000 songs and have them all be fantastic. I mean, come on. Right. That's just impossible. Right. But you still should write 3,000 songs. you know?
John, I did one of the stupidest lyrics that I ever saw in the archive in my dad's handwriting was a song called Shipping Up to Boston. And it was two verses, and it was, I'm a pirate, I have one leg, and I'm shipping up to Boston. And that's it. That's the whole song. Well, Dropkick Murphys came and wrote incredible music to it. And a lot of your audience out there might know the song Shipping Up to Boston by Dropkick Murphys. And Scorsese used it in his film. I mean, it's been all over the place. The Boston Red Sox use it as their theme song now. So, you know, you never can tell. It's the relationship that the artist has to the words. It's not for me to judge if it's stupid or not or whatever. Mm-hmm. If somebody says, I connect to that, I say, go for it. See what right. you can do.
So what are you doing now? I mean, you have a lot to contribute, obviously, on a lot of different levels. And I know you're running the foundation, but what else is brewing, if I may be so bold as to ask?
I just finished recording one of my favorite composers, artists, arrangers, conductors, classical conductor, symphonic conductor. His name is David Amram. He's 94 years old. And I hear him sing. He's been recorded, his symphonies, his all kinds of other stuff, but not singing. And I heard him sing one night, and I said, I've got to get this down because you're so unique. So I just recorded 6 tracks with him. That's going to be coming out a little bit later this year. But he's a jazz. He comes out. He played with Dizzy Gillespie. He comes out of a whole. He wrote the score for Splendor in the Grass. He wrote the score for The Manchurian Candidate, the original one.
Yeah,
he wrote the score for Jack Kerouac's Pull My Daisy, the very first avant-garde film. So he has a long, long history in all kinds of classical music. Anyway, so that was what I just finished doing this week.
And that will
isn't that interesting?
Yes, totally. And totally.
But all Woody's lyrics, with a jazz band, with a guy who sounds like no other person on the planet.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. I'll tell you. Yeah. And I hope that your father's legacy continues long after you and I are not here. And I think it will, because you just can't escape how great these lyrics are. And
also, so nice of you to say.
And also the variety of subject matter and the willingness of younger musicians to approach this, and also older musicians to approach it. I mean, there's a universal aspect to this that I don't think people are aware of, but if they avail themselves of Mermaid Avenue and your upcoming project, they will be. And I want to thank you for coming on again. It's always great to talk to you, and I can't wait to hear your next project, Nora. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having me, and hi to everyone in wonderful Chicago and Wilco and all my friends there. Thanks for having me, John.
You bet. Nora Guthrie, president of Woody Guthrie Foundation, and obviously someone who has a lot to say, as did her father.